صلوا على محمد وآل محمد. أعوذ بالله من الشيطان اللعين الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. الحمد لله رب العالمين، ثم الصلاة والسلام على خاتم الأنبياء والمرسلين سيدنا ونبينا محمد وعلى أهل بيته الطيبين الطاهرين. صلى الله عليك يا رسول الله، صلى الله عليك يا سيدي ويا مولاي يا أبا عبد الله، غريب يا مظلوم كربلاء، ما خاب من تمسك بكم وأمن من لجأ إليكم. يا ليتنا فيا ليتنا كنا معكم سيدي، فنفوز والله فوزا عظيما. قال تعالى في كتابه الكريم: بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم، ولا تركنوا إلى الذين ظلموا فتمسكم النار وما لكم من دون الله من أولياء ثم لا تنصرون. صدق الله العلي العظيم. صلوا على محمد وآل محمد. Respected elders, brothers and sisters, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. How markedly different is this Muharram from the previous Muharram? The world has changed profoundly in the past 10 months. As I speak, we continue to witness one of the most horrific genocides of our lifetime. My dear brothers and sisters, in order for us to truly grasp the reality of the time that we live in, we need to unpack and discuss the prevailing ideologies that have shaped the world that we live in. Understanding our present situation necessitates a thorough examination of the path that led us here. We have a beautiful hadith from Imam Ja'far al-Sadiq salawatullahi alayhi. Where he says, Al-alimu bizamanih la tahjumu alayhi al-lawabis. Imam al-Sadiq alayhi salam and the other Imams of Ahlul Bayt, they've emphasized the importance of knowing the Imam of the time. Man mata wa lam ya'rif imam al-zamanih mata mitatan jahiliya. We know that that is a recurring theme in our hadith corpus. But in addition to knowing the Imam of each era, Imam al-Sadiq says that it is equally important for a believer to understand the time that he lives in. It is equally important to have a nuanced understanding of the socio-political forces that govern the world that we live in. That is part of our duty as believers. And the Imam says, the one who knows his time is not overwhelmed by uncertainties. We have to understand what is transpiring in the world and why it is happening. Tonight, my dear brothers and sisters, I want to shed light on one of the prevailing ideologies that shapes the political landscape today. An ideology that has had detrimental and destructive consequences for many people around the world. And that is the ideology of Zionism. Now, in order for us to make sense of what is happening in the world today, we have to step back and understand the roots of this movement, the objectives of this movement, the philosophical assumptions of this movement. Now, to begin, we need to present a definition of Zionism. What is Zionism? Now, broadly speaking, Zionism is a modern, it's a new, it's not something that is thousands of years old. It's a modern, secularist, nationalistic movement that aims to establish a Jewish homeland. It's a movement. It's a secular movement that has made it its objective to establish a homeland for the Jewish people. This ideology was born out of Europe. You know, many people might not know this, but it was the anti-Semitism that was rampant in Europe that gave birth to the Zionist movement. Zionism was not born out of the Jewish experience in the Muslim world. It was a natural reaction to the anti-Semitism that dominated Europe. So it was European anti-Semitism that gave birth to this movement. If you look at what happened to the Jewish people in Europe leading up to the Holocaust, if you look at the way that Roman Catholic countries used to treat Jews, for instance, they enforced ghettoized segregation. They would not allow Jews to live in certain areas. They banned Jewish people from taking on certain types of employment. In Roman Catholic countries, before the Holocaust, Jews were not allowed to own land. In fact, whenever diseases and plagues would break out, the Europeans would point at the Jews. They would blame them for the epidemics and the plagues. This was very different from the Jewish experience in the Muslim world. If you look at how Jews lived under Islamic rule, number one, they were not vilified the way that they were in Europe. The Jews in Muslim lands, they were known as Ahlul Kitab. Whether it is Muslim Spain, Muslim North Africa, or even Muslim Palestine, Jews and Muslims used to live side by side. In fact, my own grandparents would tell me that they remember the days in Baghdad when Muslims and Jews were living in the same neighborhood, and they used to say that we used to even babysit each other's children. Jews prospered. Of course, there are always going to be exceptions. But generally speaking, Jews fared much better under Muslim rule because Yes, they paid a jizya, but for the most part, they were given autonomy and they were allowed to self-govern. They were not banned from owning land. They were not restricted in terms of their employment opportunities. In fact, many people don't know this, but if you look at Jewish systemic theology, it was actually born in Muslim lands. One of the most famous rabbis of the Middle Ages, his name is Maimonides, he wrote in Judeo-Arabic. Maimonides wrote his magnum opus called Dalalatul Ha'irin, the guide for the skeptics that was even taught at the University of Al-Azhar. So compared to the Jewish experience in Europe, Jews did very well under Muslim rule. Now going back to what Jews faced in Europe, because of these deplorable living conditions, Zionism was born. The intellectual father of Zionism was a man by the name of Theodor Herzl. And because of the anti-Semitism that he saw in Europe, he proposed the idea of establishing a Jewish homeland. And incidentally, Theodor Herzl was actually an atheist. You know, and it's interesting that his name literally means the gift of God, but he did not believe in God, and he definitely was not a gift from God. So he proposes this idea that Jews need a safe haven. They need a Jewish homeland. So he proposes a number of options. It wasn't just Palestine that was on the table. Some options for a Jewish homeland included Uganda, Argentina, and Jerusalem. And because Herzl was not a religious man, he didn't have any special attachment to Jerusalem. So they begin this Zionist movement. Efforts, resources are pulled together to build towards, to work towards the establishment of a Jewish homeland. This began in the late 19th century. Now, many people might not know that when Zionism began and their objectives became known, some of the most fierce opponents of Zionism were Orthodox Jews. In fact, in the early 1920s, Rabbi Joseph Chaim Sonnenfeld, he established the first anti-Zionism organization in Jerusalem. And he called it the Congregation of God-Fearers. The Congregation of People with Taqwa. And the rabbi, Rabbi Joseph Chaim Sonnenfeld, he writes the following about the Zionist movement, which had been building for decades. He writes, and I'll read to you his quotation verbatim. He says, with regards to the Zionists, what am I to say? And what am I to speak? There is a great dismay in the Holy Land. He was in Jerusalem. These evil men, he refers to them as evil men, these evil men who deny the unique one and the word, world, and his holy Torah, have proclaimed with so much publicity that it is in their power to hasten redemption for the people of Israel. The idea is that the Jews lost the right to the Holy Land because of their sins, and they have to redeem their sins, and the Messiah is the one who will take them back to the Holy Land. So this Orthodox rabbi is saying that these Jews are trying to hasten the redemption for the people of Israel and gather the dispersed from all the ends of earth. And then he says, and this is very, very important, he says, they have also asserted their view that the whole difference and distinction between Israel, meaning the children of Israel, and the nations lies in nationalism, blood, and race, and that faith and religion are superfluous. And then he says, Dr. Herzl comes not from the Lord, but from the side of pollution. These are the words of one of the leading rabbis in Jerusalem in the 1920s. He says that this is not a call, a divine call. This is a satanic call. Theodore Herzl is a toxic human being. These are his words, not mine. So the first problem with Zionism is that from a traditional Orthodox perspective is that it changes the essence of what it means to be Jewish. Before Zionism, the essence of Jewishness was observing the teachings of the Torah. That was the essence of Jewishness. Zionism came forward and said what? The essence of Jewishness is ethnicity, is blood, is race, and religion is secondary. It's not essential. It's cultural. Now, at the end of the 19th century, Zionists begin influencing the British government to get an endorsement from them to establish a Jewish homeland. Some of them worked closely with government officials. They used their lobbyists to influence the British government. And this is where we get the Balfour Declaration in 1917. The Balfour Declaration was basically a public pledge by the British that we will work towards the establishment of a Jewish homeland. And the statement came in the form of a letter from Britain's Foreign Secretary to one of the leading figures of the Zionist movement in Britain, Lionel Walter Rothschild. He writes him this letter and says that we got the stamp of approval. Britain is going to fully back this project. Now, at the time, there were less than 10% Palestine was comprised of less than 10% of Jews. So what do the British begin doing? Britain begins facilitating the mass immigration of European Jews to Palestine. Between 1922 and 1935, the population of Jews in Palestine rises from 9% to 27%. Now, why is this problematic? You know, in the words of Edward Said, the famous Palestinian-American academic, he says, here you have a European power making decisions about a non-European territory. The Balfour Declaration was a flagrant dismissal of not just the presence of the native majority, but it was a dismissal even of their wishes. They were not even consulted about this mass immigration. In fact, the Balfour Declaration referred to the indigenous people of Palestine, the 90% population, it referred to them as non-Jewish communities. A complete erasure of their identity. You know, brothers and sisters, some have even argued that giving Palestine to the Jews was actually an act of anti-Semitism by the British. Because after World War I, the British saw an opportunity, like we can solve the Jewish problem that we have by sending them all somewhere else. So the Balfour Declaration, the establishment of a Jewish homeland, was inherently anti-Semitic. Because what's the message when you say the Jewish homeland is in Palestine? What does that say? That means if you're a European Jew who lives in Europe, you're not living in your real home. If you're a Jew that lives in North America, South America, in the Middle East, in the further parts of the Middle East. The idea is that you're a stranger in your country. You need to get out and go to your real home. Go back home, as the racists would say. And then what does that say about the Palestinians who are living there? You're living here, but it's not your real home, because this is a Jewish homeland. So the Balfour Declaration in many ways becomes the precursor for the 1948 Nakba, where armed forces trained by the British government are sent into Palestine and they forcibly expel over 750,000 Palestinians from their homes. They're driven out. Now, as all of this is unfolding, the question is, what were the ulama of the Shia saying as this was happening? Were they silent? Because what usually happens when Shias advocate for the struggle of the Palestinians, it is often framed, especially in our time, as the only reason why Shias care about Palestine is because they want to advocate for the geopolitical interests of certain countries. You only support Palestine because it's in the geopolitical interests of Iran. And that's the only reason why you care about Palestine. But what I'd like to demonstrate tonight, brothers and sisters, is that our ulama, they expressed solidarity with the people of Palestine long before the establishment of the Islamic Revolution in Iran. They were speaking out against the Zionists before it became trendy. And I'll give you several examples of the noble stances of our ulama to demonstrate and to show that when it comes to the resistance against the Zionists, the Shia of Ahlul Bayt have always been the tip of the spear. We're not just fighting from the background. They are always at the front lines. They're on the front lines in terms of their condemnation of the Zionist project. The first example that I want to share with you goes back 88 years ago. In 1936, a great mujtahid who hailed from Jabal Amil in South Lebanon by the name of Sayyid Muhsin al-Amin, he writes a fatwa in 1936. This is 10 years before the establishment of Israel. He writes a fatwa when he was in Syria. And this fatwa was an appeal to the Muslim and to the Arab world to support the resistance effort that was led by a Sunni scholar, Sheikh Izzuddin al-Qassam. He was urging Muslims to support the resistance against the occupying forces. And I'll read you some excerpts of that fatwa. He begins by saying, Ya ayyuhal Arab, O Arabs, ayyuhal Muslimin, ayyuhal Muslimun, O Muslims, inna ikhwanakum fi Filistin qad aqadda madaji'ahum. O Arabs, O Muslims, your brothers in Palestine are deprived of rest because of the calamities and the trials that they are facing. ما هو فيه من محنة وبلاء ففي كل ناحية دم وقتل وهدم وتدمير. This was 88 years ago. He's saying in Palestine now, wherever you look, there is blood, there is killing, there is destruction and devastation. وَإِنَّ بَنِي أَبِيكُمْ لَيُقْدِمُونَ إِقْدَامَ الْأَبِي. Your kinfolk, your Palestinian brothers and sisters, are pressing forward with noble persistence. وَيُدَافِعُونَ الدِّفَاعَ الْمُسْتَمِيتِ. And they are defending with death-defying endurance. وَقَدْ وَقَفُوا. It's as if these words were uttered today. He says, وَقَدْ وَقَفُوا عَلَى بَرْزَخٍ بَيْنَ الْجَلَاءِ وَالْفَنَاءِ وَالْحَيَاةِ وَالْبَقَاءِ. He says, your Palestinian brothers and sisters, this is in 1936. He says, they are standing between life and death. They are standing between remaining in their homes and complete expulsion. يَتَطَلَّعُونَ إِلَيْكُمْ تَطَلُّعَ الْغَرِيقِ فِي لُجَجِ التَّيَّارِ. He says, your brothers in Palestine, your sisters in Palestine, they are looking at you the way a person looks when they are drowning. They're looking at you for help.
فَلَا تَظُنُّوا عَلَيْهِمْ بِبَذْلِ التَّافِهِ الْحَقِيرِ.
Do not withhold your modest contributions.
وَقَدْ بَذَلُوا الْجَلِيلَ الْعَظِيمِ.
Don't withhold your modest contributions while they are sacrificing what is significant and great.
وَلَا تَبْخَلُوا عَلَيْهِمْ بِالْقَلِيلِ.
And do not be stingy in giving little.
وَقَدْ بَذَلُوا الْكَثِيرِ.
While they have sacrificed a lot in terms of wealth and life and children. This was in 1936. In 1931, a second example. In 1931, the Marja' of the Shia, Sheikh Ja'far Kashif al-Ghita, he made a historic visit to Jerusalem, accepting an invitation from the Mufti of Jerusalem. He invited Sheikh Ja'far to an Islamic conference in Jerusalem. You know, there was a time when Sunnis and Shias used to work together. But now, because we don't work together enough, you have almost 2 billion Muslims in the world and they can't even send a bottle of water to Gaza.
This is what happens when we're disunited. Sheikh Ja'far goes to Jerusalem, invited by the Mufti of Jerusalem. He leads Salah in Masjid al-Aqsa. He leads Jama'ah prayer in Masjid al-Aqsa.
And he goes and he visits Palestinian families in the villages and in the towns, and he expresses his support to them, and he expresses his solidarity with them. And then in 1938, this was 10 years before the establishment of Israel, in 1938, Sheikh Ja'far Kashif al-Ghita, the Marja' of the Shias, do you know what he says? He issues a public letter. He says, Ya ayyuhal Arab, O Arabs, wa ya ayyuhal Muslimun, O Muslims,
bal ya ayyuhal Bashar wa ya ayyuhal Nas.
He says, in fact, I'm addressing humanity. What does he say?
لقد أصبح الجهاد في فلسطين واجبا على كل إنسان.
Sheikh Ja'far Kashif al-Ghita, in 1938, this is a marja' giving a fatwa. He says it is an obligation upon every individual to go to Palestine and resist the occupiers. Wherever you are in the world, it's not wajib kifa'i. Wajib aini upon everyone. And then you know what he says? This is the highest religious authority in the Shia world. Do you know what he says?
وَإِنِّي ظَامِنٌ أَنَّهُ كَالْمُجَاهِدِ مَعَ النَّبِيِّ فِي مَعْرَكَةِ بَدْرِ.
Sheikh Ja'far Kashif al-Ghita, he says, and I guarantee you, as the marja of the Shia, that if you go and you resist the occupying forces, he says, you are like the ones who fought with Rasulullah in the Battle of Badr. And then what does he say?
وَمَنْ لَمْ يَسْتَطِعَ اللِّحَاقَ بِنَفْسِهِ.
He says, if you are unable to go and to travel to that holy land,
فَلْيُمْدِدْهُمْ بِمَالِهِ.
Your next obligation is to support the resistance with your money. And then at the end of the letter, he says, I swear by Allah that if I wasn't an old man in my 70s with health issues,
لَكُنْتُ أَوَّلَ مَنْ يُلَبِّي هَذِهِ الدَّعْوَةِ.
If it wasn't for my age and my health, I would be the first one to respond to this call. ولشخصت اليوم إلى تلك البلاد المقدسة. I would go today to the holy land كما شخصت إليها بالأمس. Just as I went and visited Jerusalem many years ago. That's the second example of a high-ranking Shi'i scholar publicly supporting the Palestinian cause. It's nothing to do with Iran. It's not about politics. It's about taqwa. It's about fear of God. The third example, in 1948, Sayyid Abdul Hussein Sharaf al-Din, the author of Muraja'at, in 1948, this is when the state of Israel was established, he issues a statement. He says, أَلَا وَإِنَّ قَتْلَةَ الْحُسَيْنِ بِكْرٌ فِي الْقَتْلَاتِ. He invokes the story of Imam al-Hussein. He says, know that the killing of Hussein was something that was unparalleled and unique. فَلْتَكُنْ قُدْوَتَنَا بِهِ بِكْرٌ فِي الْقُدْوَاتِ. Then let us be our commitment to Hussein also unique. And then what does he say? He says, وَلْنَكُنْ نَحْنُ مِنْ فِلِسْطِينَ مَكَانَ الْحُسَيْنِ مِنْ قَضِيَّتِهِ. Sayyid Sharaf al-Din, do you know what he says? He says, let our commitment to Palestine be like Imam al-Hussein's commitment to his mission. This is what our ulama say. And then he says, أَيُّهَا الْعَرَبِ. O Arabs, أيها المسلمون, لقد حم الأجل. He said, the time has come, O Arabs, O Muslims. وموعدنا فلسطين, and our meeting place is Palestine. على أرضها نحيا وفيها نموت. Upon its land we shall live, and upon its land we shall die. It's not just a humanitarian issue. Look at how the leading scholars of our madhab are speaking. And then you compare it with some of the others in the Muslim world who are spending all of their time normalizing relations with Israel. We should be proud that we come from a tradition of noble scholars, fearless scholars, who will speak the truth, even if they are standing in front of the superpowers of the world. This is Sayyid Abdul Hussein Sharaf al-Din. The fourth example of Shia scholars resisting the Zionist project is in 1967 by Sayyid Muhsin al-Hakim, rahmatullahi alayh, the great marja of the Shia world. In 1967, he sends a lengthy letter to the Islamic World Conference in Jordan, urging all Muslim leaders to liberate and remove the occupying forces from Palestine. And he also sends a telegram to, not the telegram that we have, this was long before the telegram that we use. He sends a telegram to Abdul Rahman Muhammad Arif, the president of Iraq. And he says to him that you must work diligently to liberate the Holy Land from the Zionist occupiers. This is Sayyid Muhsin al-Hakim. Fifth example, as Sayyid Abu al-Qasim al-Khu'i, rahmatullahi alayhi, the great marja', Ustadh al-Fuqaha'i wal-Maraja'. In October 1973, Sayyid al-Khu'i organizes a scholarly gathering in the shrine of Amir al-Mu'mineen. The ulama, the mujtahids, the maraj of Najaf, they all congregate in the shrine of Amir al-Mu'mineen, and they come together to express their support and their solidarity with the oppressed people of Palestine. And then Sayyid al-Khu'i, do you know what he does? He sends a letter to the Shah of Iran, and he says to him that I demand that you place sanctions on Israel and you stop selling them oil. You think our ulama, they're just sitting and watching these world events unfold, and you think that they haven't taken noble stances on these issues? This is Sayyid al-Khu'i.
And then we go to Imam Khomeini rahmatullahi alayh, this visionary. On August 7th, 1979, he takes it even a step further. He declares the last Friday in the month of Ramadan as Quds Day. A day in which all Muslims unite and offer their support for the Palestinian struggle against the Zionists. He established it as a day to be remembered on an annual basis, a day in which Muslims showcase their unity and their strength. This was in 1979. And then you have Sayyid al-Khamenei, Dama Dhillu. I think you would struggle to find a scholar who has spoken more about the issue of Palestine than Sayyid al-Khamenei. Among the many statements that he has uttered, he says the following. Today, the issue of Palestine is the issue of the Islamic world. It's not a peripheral issue. It is the issue of the Islamic world. And then he says, the destiny of Palestine is the destiny of us all. When you think about the dhuhur of the 12th Imam, who do you think is going to be the most powerful force of kufr in the face of Imam Sahib al-Zaman? The eighth example, we come to Sayyid al-Sistani. May Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala prolong his life. He has made many statements about Palestine. And I'll just select three examples. In 2008, when Israel attacked certain regions in Palestine, he issued a statement. In his 2008 statement, the Sayyid mentioned a number of points. Among the points that he mentions is that he affirms the right of the Palestinian people to resist in order to reclaim their usurped rights. He expresses support for those who are resisting the occupying forces, especially in the lands that have been usurped. Number two, he emphasizes the necessity of Muslims around the world to unite around the Palestinian cause. And number three, he underscores the idea that supporting Palestine is not just a humanitarian issue. He says supporting the oppressed people of Palestine is a religious and legal duty before Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. On March 6th, 2021, when Pope Francis made his historic visit to Najaf to meet with Sayyid al-Sistani, they met for almost an hour. Among the things that Sayyid al-Sistani mentioned, he mentioned to the Pope that something must be done to help the oppressed people of Palestine. Among the things that could have been mentioned, the Sayyid emphasizes the issue of Palestine. And his most recent statement, on October 11th, 2023, he says, and I'll just read this excerpt. He says, ending the tragedy of the respected people of Palestine, which has persisted for seven decades. History did not begin on October 7th. He says, ending the tragedy of the respected people of Palestine, which has persisted for seven decades, by granting them their legitimate rights and removing the occupation is the only way to bring security to this region. You want to resolve this issue? It's not about a two-state solution. It's about giving back the rights that were usurped. And then he says, without this, this resistance to the aggressors will continue and the cycle of violence will keep claiming more innocent lives. These are just a few examples of our ulama who've showed us that advocating for the Palestinian cause has nothing to do with playing a political game. Something that predates the Islamic revolution because it is an Islamic obligation. Now you might ask,
Where does this strength in our ulama come from? Why are they so uncompromising when it comes to dhulm, to oppression? It's because they take their teachings from the icons of justice, from Ahlul Bayt, salawatullahi alayhim ajma'in. And I'll just give you two examples to highlight the beauty of our tradition and to show how uncompromising Ahlul Bayt were when it came to oppression. When Amir al-Mu'mineen, alayhi salam, when he was on his deathbed, and when you're on your deathbed, you limit your conversations to what is necessary. You limit your words to what is necessary. Amir al-Mu'mineen, on his deathbed, he looks at Hassan and Hussein and he says to them and to all of us, وَكُونَا لِلظَّالِمِ خَصْمًا وَلِلْمَظْلُومِ عَوْنًا. Amir al-Mu'mineen, he says, and be to the oppressor. And the Imam doesn't qualify the word oppressor. He doesn't say the non-Muslim oppressor. No, no, no. It doesn't matter who they are. If they are oppressors, whether they are Muslims or non-Muslims, you have to oppose them. كُونَا لِلظَّالِمِ خَصْمًا وَلِلْمَظْلُومِ عَوْنًا. And support the mazloom. Support the oppressed, whoever it may be. These were the dying words of Amir al-Mu'mineen. And if you look at to what Imam Musa ibn Ja'far taught us, Imam Musa al-Kadhim, salawatullahi alayhi, it is narrated that one of his companions by the name of Safwan al-Jammal, he comes to Imam al-Kadhim. The Imam greets him and he says, Ya Safwan, kullu shay'in minka hasanun jameel. Everything about you is beautiful, except for one thing. There's one thing about you that disappoints me, that I disapprove of. He said, Ya Ibn Rasulullah, what is it? He says, the fact that you rent your camels to Harun al-Rashid. Safwan, he tries to justify his business transactions with Harun. He says, Ya Ibn Rasulullah, I rent my camels out to him so that he can go for Hajj. Imam Musa al-Kadhim alayhi salam, he says to him, when do you take payment from him? Does he give you the money up front? Or does he pay you when he comes back? He says, no, he pays me when he comes back. Imam Musa al-Kadhim says, do you want Harun al-Rashid to stay alive long enough for him to pay you back? He says, yes. Imam Musa al-Kadhim says, من أراد بقاءهم فهو منهم. Imam al-Kadhim says, the one who wishes for them to remain is one of them. This is what Ahlul Bayt have taught. You're not going to find a merger of the Shia sitting and trying to normalize relations with Israel. No, no, no. The stance of our ulama has been clear. And they were doing it before it was popular, before it was trendy. And they do it because they were taught by the Prophet and his family. And we're honored that we come from a tradition where the kings and the rulers, they have to come to the doorsteps of our marajir. You're not going to find Sayyidi Sistani at the doorstep of any sultan, any king, any prime minister. They, on the other hand, beg, they wish that they can have a private audience with him. And that is when you know that you have righteous scholars. When the ulama are at the door of the sultan, that's when you have to worry about your religion. But when the sultans and the kings are begging to meet with your leaders and they still don't give them the light of day, that's when you know that you have scholars who are on the path of Ali ibn Abi Talib. That's when you can walk with pride and know that this is our tradition. These are the protectors of Islam, and these are the scholars who have vision, who understand the dangerous ideologies that have prevailed today, and who serve as the tip of the spear in the resistance against the Zionist movement. And they draw inspiration none other than Abi Abdullah al-Hussein. Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, it is said that when Muawiyah passed away, Yazid summoned his ministers and his aides, and he sent letters to all of the governors commanding that they take allegiance from the people in their districts, declaring himself the commander of the faithful, the Khalifa of Rasulullah, a man who used to openly drink and fornicate and kill innocent people, who had no regard for the Quran or any shred of decency. This man has now put himself forward as the representative of the Prophet. So he sends a letter to his governor in Medina, Walid ibn Utbah, and he says to him, you must immediately get the bay'ah of Hussein. If he refuses, cut his head off. So they summon Imam al-Hussein, and they tell him that this is the demand. Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, knowing very well that his life would be in danger, Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, he says, Yazid is a corrupt person. Yazid rajulun fasiq mu'linun bil fisq wa mithli la yubayu'u mithla. Someone like me. He doesn't say Hussein will not give bay'ah to Yazid. Imam doesn't want you to think that this is a personal conflict. Someone like me cannot give allegiance to someone like him. It would be humiliation for Islam. Hayhat minna dhilla. Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam knows that his enemies are vicious. He knows that he cannot remain in Medina anymore. Can you imagine how difficult it must have been for Imam al-Hussein to look around Medina and to know that he has to leave the city that he was born in? He has memories all over the city of Medina. When he looks at the alleyways of Medina, he could remember Rasulullah. He still has memories of his mother Fatima in Medina. But he goes to his family and he says that we have to leave tonight. Aba Abdullah, why are you taking the women and the children? The Imam knows that the Umayyads are wicked people, and if he doesn't take his women and children, they will apprehend those women and children. They will abuse the women of Ahlul Bayt. But before Imam al-Hussein leaves, he wants to go and give farewell to Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa sallam. He goes to the grave of the Prophet. Imagine in the dark of the night, you're in Medina and you see your Imam. You see Imam al-Hussein standing in front of the grave of Rasulullah. And he says, As-salamu alayka ya Rasulullah. As-salamu alayka ya Nabi Allah. He goes and he visits his grandfather, Rasulullah. He offers a 2-rak'ah prayer besides the grave of Rasulullah. He spends the entire night in worship besides the grave of Rasulullah. Imagine how he felt, all of those memories. The memories of him running into the masjid as a child. He would run into the masjid and he would trip, and Rasulullah would come down from the mimbar and bring him on the mimbar. As-salamu alayka ya Rasulullah. As-salamu alayka ya
خير خلق الله. As he's reciting the ziyara of Rasulullah, as he's offering his salah, the narrations say that when he goes down into sujood, it was very late at night and the imam was tired. The narrations say that he fell asleep for a few moments in sujood. Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, he had a dream. In the dream, he sees his grandfather, Rasulullah. The moment he sees Rasulullah in his dream, he says to Rasulullah, Ya Rasulullah, ana al-Hussein ibn Ali. Ya Rasulullah, I am Hussein, the daughter, the son of your daughter, Fatima. Why does Hussein say this? Ya Aba Abdullah, why are you introducing yourself to your grandfather? It's because Hussein is an older man now. When Rasulullah died, he was a young boy. It's as if he's saying to Rasulullah, oh my grandfather, do you recognize me? Do you recognize the gray hairs? I am your Hussein. I am the son of your daughter Fatima. Ana al-Hussein ibn Fatima. Farhuka wa ibn farhatik. Ya Rasul Allah. What does he say to his grandfather? He says, Ya Jadda, ضمني عندك يا جدا في هذا الضريح يا رسول الله. Keep me here with you, Ya Rasulallah. I don't want to go back to the world, Ya Rasulallah. How sweet it is to see you, Ya Rasulallah. Embrace me, Ya Rasulallah. Keep me here with you, Ya Rasulallah. I do not want to go back to the world. What does the Prophet say? The hadith says, Rasulullah looks at Hussein and he says, Bi Abi Ad. Rasulullah says, O Hussein, may my father be sacrificed for you, O Hussein. He says to him, may my father be sacrificed for you, Ya Aba Abdullah, كأني أراك, كأني أراك مرملا بدمك. Ya Hussein, I can see you now very soon, drenched in your own blood, بين يدي عصابة من أمتي. I can see you very soon, oh my beloved Hussein. I can see you drenched in blood, surrounded by members of my ummah. يرجون شفاعتي. They will hope to have my intercession. May Allah never grant them my intercession. O Hussein, innaka qadimun ala abika wa ummika wa akhik. Don't worry, O Hussein. Very soon you will see your father, Amir al-Mu'mineen. Very soon you will be reunited with your mother, Fatima. Very soon you will be reunited with your brother, Hassan. O Aba Abdullah, if you want to stay, you can stay. But no, O Hussein, أن لك درجة عند الله. O Hussein, but know that you have a status with Allah that cannot be achieved except through martyrdom. Ya Aba Abdullah. Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, he wakes up. They make preparations to leave the city of Medina. They bring all of the camels. They start to pack for this long journey.
the women, the children, everyone comes. Al-Abbas is there. Aliyun al-Akbar is there. Al-Qasim is there to represent his father, Imam al-Mujtaba. And then they bring Abdullah al-Radi, who was only 2 weeks old. Ya Aba Abdullah, why did you bring a two-week-old baby with you? It's as if Hussein is saying that this child cannot live without me. They mount all of the horses, but there is one person left. There is one person who has yet to mount the camel. Imam al-Hussein, he calls upon the youth of Bani Hashim. He tells them to stand and form a human corridor to create a shield. Who is coming out of the house? They prepare the way for Sayyida Zainab. Sayyida Zainab, the princess of the Hashemites. She comes out of her house with full dignity, surrounded by the men of Bani Hashim. And who is there to welcome her? The narrations say that there is Abbas. Abbas, he gets down on one knee. Abbas gives his knee to Sayyida Zainab. She steps on the knee of Abbas to get on the camel. But I say to Abbas, Ya Aba al-Fadl, where were you at the time? Where were you, O Abbas, when Shibr was hitting Zainab? Where were you, O Abbas, when Zainab was trying to farewell Hussein? Where were you when she was being pulled away from the body of her brother? Where were you when Zainab was kissing the jugular vein of Hussein? La hawla wa la quwwata illa billahi al-ali al-azim. وسيعلم الذين ظلموا أي منقلب ينقلبون والعاقبة للمتقين. صلوا على محمد وآل محمد.